Greetings, and welcome to MillerCast, TorpCast episode 21. Today we will discuss all things grain-related. Wheat flour, corn flour, etc. Or we could discuss Frank Miller and the 2008 film release of The Spirit. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Eva Mendes, co-star of The Spirit. But I can't even tell polite company her response to that suggestion. So instead, here is our usual correspondent, James Caswell.
And I'm here to introduce Doug Zeitlin, co-executive producer of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions. That's it. No zingers this time. He's let me off the hook a couple of times now, so it's about time I return the favor. Besides, we'll be saying enough insulting things through the process of this show to more than make up for it. It's also my turn to introduce Ken Halloran, special correspondent, casual man about town, and unofficial spokesman for the Will Eisner estate. Now, if we can just get him to stop spinning, we can get started. Now, normally we take actor, director, producer, writer, combinations, and we dedicate a special time to them. We had Josscast as our very first episode. We had Nightcast in dedication of M. Night Shyamalan as our anniversary episode. We also try to get things out in a timely manner, within a few days of a movie's release, so that listeners can make an informed decision on whether or not to go see the film or not. Yeah, not this time. Frank Miller may be a writer and director and comic book artist, and he may think that he's that important, but we don't.
He is pretty special. I hear they're giving out a new award at the Olympics for him, the Special Olympic Honorable Mention.
Yeah, but it doesn't count that he qualifies in the window licking on the short bus category.
All right, well, why don't we start with briefly touching on Frank Miller's career in comic books?
Are we just going to focus in on the successes, or are we going to cover the whole thing? Because covering the successes would be a lot shorter period of time.
This is true. No, let's give a little bit of background.
Well, Frank Miller first started as a penciler working for the Twilight Zone comic book. Somehow that's so appropriate.
Yeah, for a comic book writer, he makes a pretty lousy artist.
He then went on to work on some of the anthology pieces for DC. Then he switched over to Marvel, where he did some work on John Carter, Warlord of Mars. While he was at Marvel, he did a little bit of work on Spectacular Spider-Man, which led him to ask to work on the comic Daredevil. He was on Daredevil from May of 1979 through February of 1983, during which time he established a name for himself doing the film noir style of artwork. He was also responsible for creating Elektra, and also for killing her off the first time. He's also been given the credit for turning Daredevil from a second-tier character to a big-name Marvel brand.
Honestly, I don't and I never have had any sort of problems with Miller's early writing. It was pretty interesting. He's a creative guy, and I think that catching people's interest both on his work with Spider-Man and Daredevil does credit to his early years.
Yeah, I haven't read a lot of that early Daredevil stuff, but the few I have read, it was some good stuff.
Miller really made a name for himself, though, when he went back and worked a little bit with DC on a little thing called The Dark Knight Returns.
What do you say about The Dark Knight Returns? This was just a really cutting-edge idea in the 1980s. Comic books were trying out a new format, that prestige style. They were, once again, really reinventing themselves. And yes, he was at the head of this movement, the reinvention of the comic book. I mean, they went from pre-code comics to code comics to campy, really far-out stories. And he was among the pioneers of let's make things darker, grimmer, grittier, and more or less more real.
Actually, at least in the case of Batman, they'd started that process about 18 years before that. Denny O'Neill, Neil Adams, late 60s, early 70s.
Strangely enough, though, he is one of the people that gets the most credit for turning Batman dark.
Kind of love Denny O'Neill and Adams. I have nothing bad to say about them, but the stories in between there and The Dark Knight Returns were hit or miss. Some were good, some were incredibly not good. I guess my opinion of them is they weren't fun yet.
Now, The Dark Knight Returns was released around the same time as Moore's Watchmen.
That would be Alan Moore's Watchmen, just in case you don't know who Moore is.
Yeah, in case you thought I was talking about Roger Moore.
I thought you meant Mary Tyler.
Yeah.
There was a time where DC was doing one prestige format. I don't know if it was a year or a quarter, because I can't remember, because it was The Dark Knight they did in the prestige format. They did the Hawkman series in prestige format.
Longbow Hunters, Cosmic Odyssey.
But Prestige Series was an event back in the mid-80s.
Yeah, and God, you had to shell out $3 for a comic book.
So after doing Dark Knight Returns, he returned to Marvel to do Daredevil. And about that same time, he got into a dispute with the big two comic companies over the Comics Code Authority. He disagreed with it because he felt as though it was censorship. He wanted to have the right to draw naked or half-naked women and have the characters swear and show lots of blood and guts.
Well, in his defense, the Comics Code is censorship. By definition, he's correct. That's what it is. Question really was, did Marvel and DC want to push the issue about the censorship?
And they didn't.
By this time, DC, at least, was regularly publishing books they didn't submit to the code.
Including The Dark Knight Returns.
Yeah, and The Watchmen and the Green Arrow book that was out at that time. And, you know, granted, they still had their own pseudo-censorship because they actually slapped mature readers only on the covers of some of their books. Which, I'm sorry, a warning label doesn't strike me as censorship. That's just a warning label.
His response to it, though, was to go and work for an independent company by the name of Dark Horse Comics, and he created Sin City.
He owns Sin City. Dark Horse doesn't.
In 1998, he also created a limited series that was later turned into the movie 300. In 2001, he revisited The Dark Knight.
The most expensive toilet paper I've ever bought.
The Dark Knight Strikes Again had him going even darker.
It wasn't dark. It was black humor, more than anything else.
That's a very good way of putting it. It was a black humor one. It wasn't really entirely a sequel, although that's the way it was meant. It was a new style, or something of that sort.
It was at the release of The Dark Knight Strikes Again that it truly dawned on me that Miller, much like Alan Moore and a few other people, must have gotten stuck in perpetual puberty, because everything has to be about sex or drugs or violence or...
Okay, Jim, that's most of Hollywood.
I said including other people.
It does come down to sex sells. The idea of writing a comic book isn't necessarily to make art, it's to sell comics.
Heaven forbid that people do things just because they love it, or love telling stories, or they love the characters.
That's why you find that stuff free on the internet.
And then most recently, he's worked with DC on All-Star Batman and Robin the Boy Wonder. And Ken's weeping pretty much says it all. It's suffered from critical response, has never managed to hit the deadline as far as I'm able to tell.
What, just because they put out like 2 issues in 2008?
And apparently the September issue had to be recalled due to the fact that it had unobscured profanity in it.
Okay, that was a planned publicity stunt. Nobody is that incompetent without it being planned.
You've seen The Spirit, and you still think this.
I still think it was a planned publicity stunt. There's just something about the bleep, goddamn bleep. Batman having a sidekick who's the cock-sucking Batgirl that, I'm sorry, that's just wrong.
But this being said about Frank Miller, I mean, he's got his own art style, he's got his own storytelling style.
He's a star in the industry.
And he claims, in what sounds a very reverent manner, to be a protege of Will Eisner. And Michael Eisner claimed to be a protege of Walt Disney, but that's neither here nor there.
And Rick Berman claimed to be a protege of Gene Roddenberry.
So, I guess a resident expert on Will Eisner would be Mr. Ken. Would you, like, share a little bit of your knowledge with the listening audience?
Buckle in, folks. It's going to get to be a bumpy ride.
Will Eisner was one of the very, very early pioneers in the comic book industry. He was working for the aptly named Eisner Iger Shop. In those days, comic books weren't just done by the publishers. There were actually places where you'd just have an office with the guy who ran the office and a bunch of writers and artists. They'd produce the comic books and then sell it to the publisher. Jerry Iger and Will Eisner had such a company, and Eisner was the top creative guy. He worked on dozens of characters, mostly from the Quality Comics line, people like the Blackhawks, Dollman, that crew. And then in 1940, the newspaper industry noticed that all of a sudden this little upstart industry called comic books was doing gangbusters, and they decided they wanted to somehow cash in on it. So they contacted Eisner, Iger, Stop, and they basically commissioned a small 16-page comic book to be put inside the Sunday paper. And the whole thing was, is Will Eisner wanted to do a detective story. He wanted to do a two-fisted, fedora-wearing detective. The newspaper people had picked up on the fact that it was actually these costumed heroes that were selling the comic books, so they wanted a costumed hero. So Eisner took his drawing and drew in a little mask around the eyes, and okay, all of a sudden, the spirit's a masked hero. It ran better part of the decade, and then after that, Eisner went on, started trying to push the boundaries of the medium, started actually trying to write literature that just happened to be told in a graphic format, real people stories type stuff, and the stuff's out there, it's good, and it's never gotten the acclaim it deserves because it's comic books and it's not superheroes. Eisner himself was considered a visionary in a industry that was well known for its six-panel grids with lots of medium shots. Here was a guy who was channeling Orson Welles, you know, and doing these moody shots and film noir and shots through the glass of water on the table in the foreground and action happening. Layouts that, for the time, were breathtaking because no one had done it yet. To the point that today, you know how we've got Oscars for the film industry and the Tonys for the theater industry? In the comic book industry, they're called the Eisner Awards. That's how influential he was.
Share with us a little bit about who the spirit is.
Police detective Denny Colt was shot, left for dead, was actually declared dead, woke up, realized he'd been declared dead. The police had rules, regulations, etc. I don't know if Miranda was actually a part of the equation yet, but he didn't have to abide by all those rules. He could do things that a normal cop couldn't, so he never got himself declared officially alive and just started using the name of the spirit and went out and fought crime.
So he survived the bullet wounds by having some supernatural healing factor, right?
Don't get me started. No. The version of the origin story I've read, and there were actually more than one, Dr. Cobra was working on a suspended animation formula, and Denny had actually fallen face down into a puddle of it, which is why he was in suspended animation, which is why he was mistaken for being dead.
Well, we probably will be actually asking you to get into that whole other aspect of it later.
Yes, I know.
But that being said, it sounds like the spirit was kind of an archetype for the modern hero then. Again, Batman doesn't have to worry about the things that the Gotham police force do. Michael Knight doesn't have to worry about the things that the local police force does.
The archetype for your standard vigilante justice.
Archetypal in the sense that he is a good example of it. He was not the first. Batman predated him by about a year. What was different about him more than anyone else is that, first, his disguise really was just a stinky little mask. And he didn't have the Wayne Fortune backing him up. He didn't have the Batmobile and the Batcopter and the Batgyro and whatever else. He just had a mask, and he rode around town in a cab.
And he lived in the mausoleum.
Well, yeah, the whole having a cryptid in a Wildwood cemetery as their base of operations. It worked. But he was really more detective than he was superhero. He was not a guy who would go out and take on whole armies of thugs like Batman and Robin or Captain America. He got beaten up a lot. He got beaten up a hell of a lot, actually, which is part of the problem with that movie we'll get to later.
One of the things that never did seem to stop him, though, was time. He was started by Will Eisner, but when Will Eisner passed away, the spirit didn't go with him. He still managed to survive the test of time. He's been picked up through all the decades since then, even to the point where now DC is publishing the Spirit comics.
Yes, but it wasn't always this way. 40s up into the early 50s, as I said, the strip was running. Stopped cold. There was an attempt made in the 60s to revive it, but that was mostly reprints. It wasn't really until the 80s that people said, hey, what Eisner did was really good. Can we try to catch lightning in a bottle again? But honestly, what a lot of it is if you actually come across the old stories, they're good enough that you don't have to recapture lightning in a bottle. The stories are still valid. Now, granted, there's certain things like, you know, 1940s, you're not going to have computers or cell phones or any of those types of things in the story, but human beings haven't changed that much, and that's what the spirit stories were about, human beings. With real problems, the criminals, some were truly evil, but a lot were the guy out of work, hard luck, has to do something to make ends meet, he turns to crime. Very realistic.
That's kind of apropos for the beginning of 2009.
This movie should have been very pertinent.
Now, Frank Miller's The Spirit was not the first attempt to do a live-action spirit.
For those of you who recall the phenomenal 1980 hit Flash Gordon starring Sam Jones with music by Queen, Flash Gordon was not the only superhero for Sam Jones to play.
In the mid-80s, somebody got the idea of adapting the Spirit for television. They contracted with ABC that they were going to do the pilot. ABC did not pick up the show, but on July 31st, 1987, ABC showed the Spirit unaired pilot as a movie of the week. And I enjoyed it. It was actually that made me go back and read up more about who this guy was, because I was 19 years old. I didn't actually know that much about him yet.
The Spirit starred Sam Jones as the Spirit, Nana Visitor as Ellen Dolan. Yes, Nana Visitor, far before her days on Deep Space Nine.
And far before her days of learning to act.
Bumper Robinson as Yubi, McKinley Robinson as Pajel.
On the bright side, the TV series did adhere fairly closely to the origin and a good portion of the, for lack of a better term, spirit of the comic. Really, the only thing that was missing was the Dr. Cobra angle. But they were trying to put this guy who's wearing a domino mask into a very realistic world, and I'm sure that the Dr. Cobra aspect of the origin would have kind of put a little bit of a hindrance on that. But on the flip side, it, well, starred Sam Jones and Nana Visitor before she could act.
Might have been the director. You never know. I mean, they might have asked her to play as wooden as possible. There was a heavy camp aspect.
The lead bad guy was Pajel, a multimillionaire heiress who's...
Is she from the planet Krypton?
Pajel Kal-El. I understood it. I thought it was actually kind of amusing. No, Pajel was a recurring villainess who would be in the old Spirit strip. She was your classic vamp, Black Widow type.
When funds started getting a little low, she had no problem going on out and finding a rich husband and then killing him off.
Yeah, basically.
And for those of you whose only point of knowledge about the Spirit is this movie, no, she wasn't in it.
The only thing I'll add is that it was very campy, but the thing about the original Eisner strip was that sometimes, not always by any stretch, but sometimes the Spirit could be a very funny strip. Other times it would be very dark. As I intimated earlier, it was telling the gamut of human stories. It could be horrific, it could be funny, it could be straight-up detective story. So the humor wasn't completely out of place.
I still say that the biggest drawback that it had was Sam Jones.
I've liked all three movies I've ever seen Sam Jones in.
And what was the third movie he was in?
Jane and the Lost City. Jane, by the way, was a 1940s newspaper comic strip published in the British equivalent of the Stars and Stripes, their newspaper for the soldiers.
Which brings us back to Frank Miller's The Spirit. Now, Frank Miller got the idea that he could direct thanks to Robert Rodriguez. And it's the only thing that I really hold against the man. Robert Rodriguez wanted to do a live-action version of Sin City, and he wanted to do something that is rarely ever done in Hollywood, where he wanted to make things so close to the source material that you could look at the comic book and look at the movie and see frames that were in common. So he brought in Frank Miller as a consult, and thanks to Frank Miller's input, he decided to make him co-director. Now, this ended up costing Robert Rodriguez his membership in the guild because they objected to there being two directors on the film. I think they just objected to Frank Miller's participation, but that's just my biased opinion. But it was Frank Miller's participation in the Sin City movie that made him think that he could go on out and do his first solo directorial project, Frank Miller's The Spirit.
So he had this really good idea with Robert Rodriguez. They took individual panels from Sin City and they made them into individual shots in the Sin City movie. So he kept this wonderful idea and he was true to Will Eisner's vision of the Spirit, wasn't he?
For about 15 minutes.
In all seriousness, I went to go see Sin City. I like Frank Miller as a writer. I think of the three of us, I'm the one who actually has the most respect for him as a comic writer.
Easily. I know who comes in at the bottom of that list, too.
I really thought the Sin City movie sucked. I really, really hated that movie.
Which is odd because, stylistically, I liked the concept. The idea of taking these individual panels and making them scenes within the movie. And, in general, I just like most things that Robert Rodriguez does. It was an interesting concept to me, and based solely on the concept, I was able to enjoy it. The actual writing left something to be desired, but then again, we're talking about Frank Miller here.
It's one of those cases where my father took me to see it, so I didn't want to insult him. He was having a good time, he enjoyed the movie, and I didn't want to walk out on the movie that he had taken me to. For me, the only redeeming thing in that whole movie was Bruce Willis's performance. And I'm like, where did you get like a great performance like that in such a crappy movie?
Normally, I don't go for the dark and gritty type stuff. I like to walk out of a movie feeling good. So it's odd for me to say that I actually enjoyed Sin City, because there isn't really a redeeming character anywhere within the story. Even the character that you want to look at and say, this is the good guy of the story, still does something horrifically wrong.
Sin City. Sin as in doing bad things. It's right there on the tin.
But speaking of doing bad things...
Nice segue.
It brings us to Frank Miller's The Spirit. And yes, I refuse to refer to it as Will Eisner's The Spirit.
Good call.
Separating it for 1 second from the fact that it's based on Will Eisner's comic, I did not think it was a train wreck. I looked at it as an origin of a hero protecting the city. It's showing the superhero filling the roles of the archetype. And I think it did an okay job with that. It told an okay story. It had an okay love story. I mean, it had some fun fight scenes. I think there were good things in this movie.
So what you're saying is that if this movie had been about a character going by any other name but the Spirit, it could have been a good movie.
I am saying that. I mean, structurally, there are things that are wrong with it. It's a little bit inconsistent in whether it's dark or it's camp. But in general, if you call this like a first draft of a story, I'd say this is definitely a story that I would watch in a movie. There are other things that I thought were excellent also. The actor who played the Spirit, I thought he captured that role of the hero perfectly. I like the commissioner. I like the daughter. To be honest, and I think this would shock Samuel Jackson fans because I love him, he was a big detractor from the movie, because whereas I thought other people were really taking their role seriously, he was so over-the-top camp.
He didn't just nibble the scenery. He took big, huge, honking chunks out of it.
That's nothing that Sam Jackson did. As we discussed with the Nana Visitor and her role in the earlier Spirit movie, I think this was a directorial decision, that the director wanted him to chew the scenery.
It was funny because after having seen the movie, I was doing a little bit of research about who these characters were. And one of the funniest things that I found was that the octopus in the comic strips and in the comic books was supposed to be a master of disguise. That nobody ever really knew what the octopus looked like because he kept on changing his identity, kept on changing what he looked like. And it was through that it dawned on me, okay, that's what all those stupid freaking costumes was all about. That was him trying to portray Octopus as being a master of disguise. And instead, all he did was make him look stupid.
Okay,
I don't think that's what he was doing. That looked like Samuel L. Jackson saying, oh good, I was too young to be on Batman!
I have to agree with both of you. Because again, Samuel Jackson's not the costume designer. I think it was the costume designer paying tribute to the master of disguise in a way that, again, the director, I'll put the blame where I really think it lies.
According to what I read online, Jackson did have some say on the costuming.
But I was trying to figure out why the octopus was dressed in this big floppy hat and then dressed as a samurai and dressed as a Nazi soldier.
Jackson is a Nazi. That was an image to remember.
And it just didn't make any sense to me whatsoever.
If this had just been, you know, a generic superhero movie, it's still a stylistic mishmash. I mean, you can't get away from that. I mean, the whole, okay, is it dark, is it camp, it was all over the board. But as a generic superhero movie, it would have been okay.
At least on a par with Darkman.
I actually agree with that. I'm not a huge fan of Darkman. I walked out of The Spirit enjoying it at least as much as I enjoyed The Phantom when I walked out of that. And I'm a huge fan of the Phantom comic. I love that. I did not say The Phantom was a good movie. I just said that I had equal enjoyment of the two movies.
So we've hit on the concept of this being a better movie if it was something other than The Spirit. What if it had been directed by someone else? For myself, I didn't like his directorial style. As much as I enjoyed in Sin City the comparison of panel to screen, when you're trying to recapture that feel without the panels, it gets real tiring real quick.
I found the directorial style interesting.
Interesting as in, what's that attached to the bottom of my shoe?
Well, I'll be honest, I got tired of the all-black, all-white silhouette stuff. After a while, the washed out most of the colors, but leaving the red and the Aquafina label in. It was interesting for a while, but it got tiring. I understand product placement happens in movies, but the fact that the only thing that wasn't red that was in full bright color was an Aquafina label on Ellen's bottled water was just annoying.
The other product placement that really, really annoyed me was the cell phone ads. When you're doing a movie that's supposed to have a very noir feel, and it was originally done in the 1940s, and everything else seems to have almost a 1940s feel to it, 1940s cars, 1940s airplane, having all of the characters running around using cell phones felt so out of place to me. The time that it was the most obvious to me was when they whipped out the red one that folds out and has the keyboard to it and a display and all that type of stuff, which anybody who's a real cell phone aficionado would probably recognize what it was immediately.
I would argue that that wasn't so much product placement as it just felt anachronistic.
When we left the theater, though, that was one of those things that was really bugging me. If this had been a 22-minute TV one-shot, I probably could have stood it for that length of time. For it to be an hour and 30-some-odd minutes was a bit much.
To go back to your original point, would it have been better if it weren't directed by Frank Miller? I think the obvious answer to that is yes. This is his first movie. You look at what first movie directors do, they tend to do crap. This was perhaps a higher level of crap, but...
And a more expensive pile of...
I think if you wanted to do this noir-style, 1940-esque comic book hero, the guy who directed Sky Captain and the World Tomorrow would have been a better choice.
Oh, so much better choice.
Agreed. So yeah, if they could have gotten a different director and a different writer, yeah, it might have been a good film.
Now, still capping on, discussing Frank Miller. After seeing the movie, one of the things that was the most irritating to me was all of the build-up that he did in promoing the film, where he was talking about having stuck to the spirit of Will Eisner and how much he admired Will Eisner and how much he learned from Will Eisner and how much he adored Will Eisner. And after watching this film, I just kind of wondered if it wouldn't have just been easier for him to go on out and pee on Will Eisner's grave.
You know, I heard an interview with him, and one of the things that he claimed is that the most important thing of this movie is that this movie would be something that Will Eisner was proud of.
Now, as we try to resuscitate Ken... Better now?
Probably not, but we'll try.
The number of ways that you've messed up Will Eisner's vision. Let me count the ways.
Well, let Ken do it, please.
Do you remember after you guys saw it, but before I saw it, and I actually asked you which characters were in it?
C.
And you were reading off the names, and I was like, wait, they're doing a spirit movie without Pagel? How can you do a spirit movie without Pagel? I could understand them leaving out Ebony. Ebony was a cultural stereotype that would be out of favor today. Then I saw the movie, and then I started thinking, okay, how can you do a spirit movie without Ellen Dolan, or Commissioner Dolan, or the Octopus? Seriously, about the only two characters that they got the personality right on were the Spirit and Sans Serif. Everyone else...
10 degrees off-center?
15. 50 in the case of the Octopus. But Commissioner Dolan in this movie was the perfect archetype action hero police commissioner, and he did that beautifully. The only thing it wasn't was Commissioner Dolan.
What would have been more Commissioner Dolan?
A lot less antagonism towards the Spirit. In the comics, Dolan is pretty much the Spirit's closest friend. And you do have a sense of them being friends, as well as the fact that the Spirit takes some level of direction from him. A much greater sense of cooperation.
You mentioned the character of Ellen, which I find very interesting because in watching Nana Visitor's interpretation of the character, I didn't see anything other than her being the commissioner's daughter in the way of it being an accurate portrayal either.
Ellen Dolan has never been a doctor until this movie got released. That whole Dr. Ellen Dolan, I don't know where the hell that came from. Now keep in mind, this is 1940. The word feminist hadn't been invented yet, but Ellen Dolan was really one of these so-called proto-feminists. She was actually going out and trying to make her way in the world, still kind of relied on her father, and her father kind of relied on her, and she had this thing for this big, strong, masked crime fighter guy who hung around with her dad. She tried to be a career woman, mean, again, this is 1940, and it was harder in those days. But this Dr. Ellen Dolan being the person who patches up the spirit, you don't know where that came from. Samuel L. Jackson's The Octopus, as we've already kind of touched upon. Honestly, Jim Carrey's portrayal of the Riddler was closer to the comic book Riddler than Sam Jackson was to the comic book Octopus.
Oh, that's an insult. Next thing you're going to say is Tommy Lee Jones's interpretation of Two-Face was closer.
At least he looked the part. I mentioned earlier, the spirit got beat up a lot. Every couple stories, you can pretty much count on him getting a really severe beating, his blue suit being torn to shreds. He got in these nasty, brutal fights. And yes, next week, another comic came out, he was fine. This wasn't a superpower, this was just the genre. It's like John McClane in the Die Hard movies.
Takes a licking and keeps on ticking.
Yeah, and that's all it was. He's a tough guy, he gets hurt, he gets beat up, but he keeps going. And then, you know, the next time you see him, he's fine. To actually turn this into a superpower... Will Eisner didn't like superpowered people! He hated them! He liked telling stories about real people. Making the spirit a superpowered person, and then hanging the movie off of this fact, was roughly akin to saying that the Half-Blood Prince movie was going to be about Harry and Hermione's love child. It was just so wrong! The one thing I will say that they got right, the whole thing with the spirit and sand, and particularly that flashback sequence of them as kids, that was very faithful. I'd have to go back and look, but I'd go as far as to say they might have actually done that whole thing of, okay, we're going to use the comic book as a storyboard with that flashback sequence. I mean, I've read that story. It was close. It was good. That was really well done. I wasn't kidding when I said, okay, there was 15 minutes of it. But, oh man, that whole, we're going to take this trope of the genre and turn it into the MacGuffin of the movie. It's like, what the hell?
We neglected earlier to put in the spoiler alert. Yeah, we did that on purpose. We want to ruin it for you so you don't have any reason whatsoever to go see this movie.
I don't know. I'll probably watch it again someday. It was one of those that was so bad that I need to see it again.
I know you've seen Plan 9 more than once.
Yeah, okay. I plead guilty to enjoying bad movies. Yeah, three big gulps, go to Eisner's gravesite, so much cheaper.
So, what'd you really think about it?
Don't even get me started on the really, really bad Greek mythology. Because when you get to that point, that is nitpicking details. That's, you know, Spider-Man doesn't have organic web shooters level of nitpickiness, and I recognize this.
I beg to differ. Peter David came up with the organic web shooters way before Sam Raimi ever put that in the movie.
He did?
It's called Spider-Man 2099, and he had organic web shooters the whole time that comic was out.
Okay, so to wrap things up, ratings, gentlemen.
Honestly, just given the fact that I enjoyed the story itself, not necessarily as a spirit story, but I'd give it 2 pens in the pocket protector.
Out of the 4, I would probably give it 1.5 pens in the pocket protector.
I'd give it 3 train wrecks out of 4.
That actually surprises me. I thought you'd gone for the full boat.
No, he missed 1 train wreck. He got the whole thing with Denny and Sand correct. And it was the generic superhero story, decent. It's got redeeming qualities. Not many, but it's got redeeming qualities.
Part of it is the fact that the redeeming qualities don't interweave. There's things like the actress who played Ellen. I like her. I liked her on Studio 60. I think she's a great actress.
But she was really rather underused.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, that's because Miller was focusing on the Sand story, figuring that Sand is the great love of Denny's life kind of thing.
Yeah, but the way he wrote it, it seemed like any woman who was in the room was the great love of the spirit.
Yeah, he actually had 2 superpowers in this movie.
Okay, that's the other thing he got right from the Eisner comics. Denny was a stud.
I was just waiting for him to take it out and fling it over his shoulder.
The other thing I'll say about the spirit is the spirit was created in comic books nearly 70 years ago. It was stopped publishing 60 years ago. Honestly, you have to be a pretty diehard comic book aficionado to actually have any kind of familiarity with it. I kind of knew who he was, but until I saw the telefilm in 87, I'd read exactly 1 spirit story prior to that. The whole idea that, okay, we're going to take this property that pretty much, if it's in the public consciousness, it's in the public consciousness of people who are all 65 and older. There's a certain amount of, okay, who is the target audience here? The average comic book reader today, who's about our age, which, you know, late 30s, early 40s, which is just a sad state of the comic book industry, really, it isn't going to be that well known. could be that a lot of the details that, yeah, somebody like me who's on the anal retentive side is going to say, no, that's wrong. If you don't know about the details, you can't comment on them.
You know, we talked earlier, sex sells and stuff like that. There is a stylized comic book movie, and that's the movie that sells well. And as much as I enjoy the X-Men movies, and I enjoy the Spider-Man movies, I enjoy the Fantastic Four movies, they're formulaic. This is what a superhero movie is. And the spirit shouldn't have fit that mold.
Yeah.
From a production company point of view, I point out Superman Returns, which I think you have to be a Superman fan to really enjoy. Was just a spectacular story, but it didn't have the big fight at the ending. It had the 20 minutes where people were really concerned over, was the Man of Steel going to live or die?
Yeah, they went for the drama effect. And there are still a lot of comic fans who are still pissed off about the Super Baby. The whole Superman is deadbeat dad kind of thing, which, yeah, I can see their point there.
Any last thoughts? Any parting shots, I should say.
So is it Miller time?
If after having listened to us go on for this length of time, ripping this movie a new one, you still want to go and see it,
you deserve to lose your $10.
Do us a favor, rent it on DVD. That way it doesn't count towards the box office totals, and it doesn't give them a good reason to make The Spirit 2.
And if you're really intent on spending that $10, send it to us at TwerpCast and just hit yourself in the nuts with a hammer.
You'll get about the same level of enjoyment.
No, I really liked it. I'm going overboard.
I don't know. The flesh was willing, but the spirit was weak.
As always, thank you for listening to TwerpCast. We encourage your feedback. Please write jim@twerponline.net.
Thanks for listening, everybody. This has been a production of Timewell Electronic Recording Productions, copyright 2009. Can you believe we're in 2009 already?